This is Chapter a Day. I'm Norman Gilliland, reading again from The Picture of Dorian Gray by Oscar Wilde, published originally in serial form and then in book form in 1990, and of course many times since then. It's the story of painter Basil Hallward, his friend Lord Henry Wotton, and their mutual friend, the young and terribly handsome and compelling Dorian Gray. And Basil has just finished painting a portrait of Dorian Gray that is so beautiful that he has put himself into it, heart and soul, and wants to keep it private. And it does go only into the hands of Dorian Gray without any kind of exhibition involved. In the meantime, Lord Henry, almost always the cynic, tells Dorian that while the painting will be always beautiful, he, Dorian, will age, grow old, and ugly. And Dorian, at that time, then expresses the wish that he could exchange his soul for being eternally young and handsome while the painting ages in his place. The friendship among the three becomes tested now when Dorian Gray falls in love head over heels with a young actress. She's only 16 or 17 years old. Her name is Sybil Vane, and he's totally enthralled with her playing of various Shakespeare heroines, even though she performs in a tawdry little low-class theater. He finds her a diamond in that rough, and now he wants to, as it were, show her off to his friends, Basil and Lord Henry. And they all go to the theater to see Sybil Vane acting. For some reason or other, the house was crowded that night, and the fat manager who met them at the door was beaming from ear to ear with an oily, tremulous smile. He escorted them to their box with a sort of pompous humility, waving his fat, jeweled hands and talking at the top of his voice. Dorian Gray loathed him more than ever. He felt as if he had come to look for Miranda and had been met by Caliban. Lord Henry, upon the other hand, rather liked him. At least, he declared he did, and insisted on shaking him by the hand and assuring him that he was proud to meet a man who had discovered a real genius and gone bankrupt over a poet. Hallward amused himself with watching the faces in the pit. The heat was terribly oppressive, and the huge sunlight flamed like a monstrous dahlia with petals of yellow fire. The youths in the gallery had taken off their coats and waistcoats and hung them over the side. They talked to each other across the theater and shared their oranges with the tawdry girls who sat beside them. Some women were laughing in the pit. Their voices were horribly shrill and discordant. The sound of the popping of corks came from the bar. "What a place to find one's divinity in," said Lord Henry. "Yes," answered Dorian Gray. "It was here I found her, and she is divine beyond all living things. When she acts, you will forget everything. These common, rough people, with their coarse faces and brutal gestures, become quite different when she is on the stage. They sit silently and watch her. They weep and laugh as she wills them to do. She makes them as responsive as a violin. She spiritualizes them, and one feels that they are of the same flesh and blood as oneself."
"The same flesh and blood as oneself? Oh, I hope not," exclaimed Lord Henry, who was scanning the occupants of the gallery through his opera glass.
"Don't pay any attention to him, Dorian," said the painter. "I understand what you mean, and I believe in this girl. Anyone you love must be marvelous, and any girl that has the effect you describe must be fine and noble. To spiritualize one's age, that is something worth doing. If this girl can give a soul to those who have lived without one,
If she can create the sense of beauty in people whose lives have been sordid and ugly, if she can strip them of their selfishness and lend them tears for sorrows that are not their own, if she can do all that, she is worthy of all your adoration, worthy of the adoration of the world. This marriage, your marriage to her, is quite right. I did not think so at first, but I admit it now. The gods made Sybil Vane for you. Without her, you would have been incomplete.
Thanks, Basil, answered Dorian Gray, pressing his hand. I knew you would understand me. Harry is so cynical, he terrifies me.
But here's the orchestra. It is quite dreadful, but it only lasts for, about 5 minutes. Then the curtain rises, and you will see the girl whom I'm going to give all my life, to whom I have given everything that is good in me. A quarter of an hour afterwards, amidst an extraordinary turmoil of applause, Sybil Vane stepped onto the stage. Yes, she was certainly lovely to look at. One of the loveliest creatures Lord Henry thought that he had ever seen. There was something of the fawn in her shy grace and startled eyes, a faint blush, like the shadow of a rose in a mirror of silver, came to her cheeks as she glanced at the crowded, enthusiastic house. She stepped back a few paces, and her lips seemed to tremble. Basil Hallward leaped to his feet and began to applaud. Motionless, and as one in a dream, sat Dorian Gray, gazing at her. Lord Henry peered through his glasses, murmuring, "Charming, charming." The scene was the hall of Capulet's house, and Romeo in his pilgrim's dress had entered with Mercutio and his other friends. The band, such as it was, struck up a few bars of music, and the dance began. Through the crowd of ungainly, shabbily dressed actors, Sybil Vane moved like a creature from a finer world. Her body swayed while she danced, as a plant sways in the water. The curves of her throat were the curves of a white lily. Her hands seemed to be made of cool ivory. Yet she was curiously listless. She showed no sign of joy when her eyes rested on Romeo. The few words she had to speak, with the brief dialogue that followed, were spoken in a thoroughly artificial manner. Now, the voice was exquisite, but from the point of view of tone, it was absolutely false. It was wrong in color. It took away all the life from the verse. It made the passion unreal. Dorian Gray grew pale as he watched her. He was puzzled and anxious. Neither of his friends dared to say anything to him. She seemed to them to be absolutely incompetent. They were horribly disappointed. Yet they felt that the true test of any Juliet is the balcony scene of the second act. They waited for that. If she failed there, there was nothing in her. She looked charming as she came out in the moonlight. That could not be denied. But the staginess of her acting was unbearable and grew worse as she went on. Her gestures became absolutely artificial. She overemphasized everything that she had to say. She spoke the words as though they conveyed no meaning to her. It was not nervousness. Indeed, so far from being nervous, she was absolutely self-contained. It was simply bad art. She was a complete failure. Even the common, uneducated audience of the pit and gallery lost their interest in the play. They got restless and began to talk loudly and to whistle. The manager, who was standing at the back of the dress circle, stamped and swore with rage. The only person unmoved was the girl herself.
When the second act was over, there came a storm of hisses, and Lord Henry got up from his chair and put on his coat.
She is quite beautiful, Dorian, but she can't act. Let us go.
I'm going to see the play through, answered the lad in a hard, bitter voice. I'm awfully sorry that I've made you waste an evening, Harry. I apologize to you both.
My dear Dorian, I should think Miss Vane was ill, interrupted Hallward.
We'll come some other night.
I wish she were ill. But she seems to me to be simply callous and cold. She has entirely altered. Last night she was a great artist. This evening she is merely a commonplace, mediocre actress.
Don't talk like that about anyone you love, Dorian. Love is a more wonderful thing than art.
They are both simply forms of imitation, remarked Lord Henry.
But do let us go, Dorian.
You must not stay here any longer. It's not good for one's morals to see bad acting. Besides, I don't suppose you will want your wife to act, so what does it matter if she plays Juliet like a wooden doll? And she is very lovely, and if she knows as little about life as she does about acting, well, she will be a delightful experience.
There are only two kinds of people who are really fascinating. People who know absolutely everything and people who know absolutely nothing.
Good heavens, my dear boy, don't look so tragic.
The secret of remaining young is never to have an emotion that is unbecoming.
Come to the club with Basil and myself. We'll smoke cigarettes and drink to the beauty of Sybil Vane. She is beautiful.
What more can you want?
Go away, Harry.
I want to be alone.
Basil, you must go.
Can't you see that my heart is breaking?
The hot tears came to his eyes, his lips trembled, and rushing to the back of the box, he leaned up against the wall, hiding his face in his hands.
Let us go, Basil,
said Lord Henry with a strange tenderness in his voice, and the two young men passed out together. A few moments afterwards, the floodlights flared up, and the curtain rose on the third act. Dorian Gray went back to his seat. He looked pale and proud and indifferent. The play dragged on and seemed interminable. Half of the audience went out, tramping in heavy boots and laughing. The whole thing was a fiasco. The last act was played to almost empty benches. The curtain went down on a titter and some groans. As soon as it was over, Dorian Gray rushed behind the scenes into the green room. The girl was standing there alone with a look of triumph on her face. Her eyes were lit with an exquisite fire. There was a radiance about her. Her parted lips were smiling over some secret of their own. When he entered, she looked at him, and an expression of infinite joy came over her.
"How badly I acted tonight, Dorian!"
"Horribly," he answered, gazing at her in amazement. "Horribly!
It was dreadful. Are you ill?"
"You have no idea what it was. You have no idea what I suffered." The girl smiled.
"Dorian!"
She lingered over his name with long-drawn music in her voice, as though it were sweeter than honey to the red petals of her mouth.
"Dorian!"
"You should have understood. But you understand now, don't you?"
"Understand what?"
"Why, I was so bad tonight. Why, I shall always be bad. Why, I shall never act well again." He shrugged his shoulders.
"You are ill, I suppose. When you are ill, you shouldn't act. You make yourself ridiculous. My friends were bored. I was bored."
She seemed not to listen to him.
She was transfigured with joy. An ecstasy of happiness dominated her.
"Dorian, Dorian! Before I knew you, acting was the only reality in my life. It was only in the theater that I lived. I thought that it was all true. I was Rosalind one night and Portia the other. The joy of Beatrice was my joy. The sorrows of Cordelia were mine also. I believed in everything. The common people who acted with me seemed to me to be godlike. The painted scenes were my world. I knew nothing but shadows, and I thought them real. You came, oh, my beautiful love, and you freed my soul from prison. You taught me what reality really is. Tonight, for the first time in my life, I saw through the hollowness, the sham, the silliness of the empty pageant in which I had always played. Tonight, for the first time, I became conscious that the Romeo was hideous and old and painted, that the moonlight in the orchard was false, that the scenery was vulgar, and that the words I had to speak were unreal, were not my words, were not what I wanted to say. You had brought me something higher, something of which all art is but a reflection. You had made me understand what love really is. My love, Prince Charming, Prince of Life. I have grown sick of shadows. You are more to me than all art can ever be. What have I to do with the puppets of a play? When I came in tonight, I could not understand how it was that everything had gone from me. I thought that I was going to be wonderful. I found that I could do nothing. Suddenly it dawned on my soul what it all meant. The language was exquisite to me. I heard them hissing, and I smiled. What could they know of love such as ours? Take me away, Dorian. Take me away with you where we can be quite alone. I hate the stage. I might mimic a passion that I do not feel, but I cannot mimic one that burns me like fire. Oh, Dorian, Dorian, you understand now what it signifies, even if I could do it. It would be profanation for me to play at being in love. You have made me see that. He flung himself down on the sofa and turned away his face. "You have killed my love," he muttered. She looked at him in wonder and laughed. He made no answer. She came across to him and with her little fingers stroked his hair. She knelt down and pressed his hands to her lips. He drew them away and a shudder ran through him. Then he leaped up and went to the door. "Yes, you have killed my love. You used to stir my imagination. Now you don't even stir my curiosity. You simply produce no effect. I loved you because you were marvelous, because you had genius and intellect, because you realized the dreams of great poets and gave shape and substance to the shadows of art. You've thrown it all away. You are shallow and stupid. My God, how mad I was to love you. What a fool I have been. You're nothing to me now. I will never see you again. I will never think of you. I will never mention your name. You don't know what you were to me once." The girl grew white and trembled. She clenched her hands together and her voice seemed to catch in her throat. "You're not serious, Dorian. You're acting. Acting. I leave that to you. You do it so well." She rose from her knees and, with an expression of pain in her face, came across the room to him. She put her hand upon his arm and looked into his eyes. He thrust her back. "Don't touch me." A low moan broke from her, and she flung herself at his feet and lay there like a trampled flower,
Dorian, Dorian, don't leave me.
I'm going, he said at last, in his calm, clear voice. I don't wish to be unkind, but I can't see you again. You have disappointed me.
She wept silently and made no answer, but crept nearer. Her little hands stretched blindly out and appeared to be seeking for him. He turned on his heel and left the room. In a few moments, he was out of the theater. Where he went, he hardly knew. He remembered wandering through dimly lit streets, past gaunt, black-shadowed archways and evil-looking houses. Women with hoarse voices and harsh laughter had called after him. Drunkards had reeled by, cursing and chattering to themselves like monstrous apes. He had seen grotesque children huddled upon doorsteps and heard shrieks and oaths from gloomy courts. After a while, he hailed a hansom and drove home. In the huge gilt Victorian lantern, spoil of some doge's barge that hung from the ceiling of the great oak-paneled hall of entrance, lights were still burning from the three flickering jets, thin blue petals of flame. They seemed rimmed with white fire. He turned them out, and having thrown his hat and cape on the table, passed through the library towards the door of his bedroom. A large octagonal chamber on the ground floor that in his newborn feeling for luxury he had just had decorated for himself and hung with some curious Renaissance tapestries that had been discovered stored in a disused attic at Selby Royal. As he was turning the handle of the door, his eye fell upon the portrait Basil Hallward had painted of him. He started back as if in surprise. Then he went on into his own room, looking somewhat puzzled. After he had taken the buttonhole out of his coat, he seemed to hesitate. Finally, he came back, went over to the picture, and examined it. In the dim arrested light that struggled through the cream-colored silk blinds, the face appeared to him to be a little changed. The expression looked different. One would have said that there was a touch of cruelty in the mouth. It was certainly strange. He turned round and, walking to the window, threw up the blind. The bright dawn flooded the room and swept the fantastic shadows into dusky corners where they lay shuddering. But the strange expression that he had noticed in the face of the portrait seemed to linger there, to be more intensified even. The quivering, ardent sunlight showed him the lines of cruelty round the mouth as clearly as if it had been something that he saw in a mirror after he had done some dreadful thing. He winced, and taking up from the table an oval glass framed in ivory cupids, one of Lord Henry's many presents to him, he glanced hurriedly into its polished depths. No line like that warped his red lips. What did it mean? He rubbed his eyes and came close to the picture and examined it again. There were no signs of any change when he looked into the actual painting, and yet there was no doubt that the whole expression had altered. It was not a mere fancy of his own. The thing was horribly apparent. He threw himself into a chair and began to think. Suddenly there flashed across his mind what he had said at Basil Hallward's studio the day the picture had been finished. Yes, he remembered it perfectly. He had uttered a mad wish that he himself might remain young and the portrait grow old, that his own beauty might be untarnished and the face on the canvas bear the burden of his passions and his sins, that the painted image might be seared with the lines of suffering and thought, and that he might keep all the delicate bloom and loveliness of his then just conscious boyhood. Surely his wish had not been fulfilled. Such things were impossible. It seemed monstrous even to think of them. And yet, there was the picture before him, with the touch of cruelty in the mouth. No, it was merely an illusion wrought on the troubled atmosphere of the time, of the moment. The horrible night that he had passed had left phantoms behind it. Suddenly there had fallen upon his brain that tiny scarlet speck that makes men mad. The picture had not changed. It was folly to think so. Yet it was watching him with its beautiful, marred face and its cruel smile. Its bright hair gleamed in the surly sunlight. Its blue eyes met his own. A sense of infinite pity, not for himself, but for the painted image of himself, came over him. It had altered already, and would alter more. Its gold would wither into gray. Its red and white roses would die. For every sin that he committed, a stain would fleck and wreck its fairness. But he would not sin. The picture, changed or unchanged, would be to him the visible emblem of conscience. He would resist temptation. He would not see Lord Henry anymore, would not at any rate listen to those subtle, poisonous theories that had in Basil Hallward's garden, had first stirred within him the passion for impossible things. He would go back to Sybil Vane, make her amends, marry her, try to love her again. Yes, it was his duty to do so. She must have suffered more than he had. Poor child. He had been selfish and cruel to her. The fascination that she had exercised over him would return. They would be happy together. His life with her would be beautiful and pure. The name of the book is The Picture of Dorian Gray. It's by Oscar Wilde, published for the first time in full in 1890. And we'll read from it again next time. I'm Norman Gilliland. This is Chapter a Day.